It is the Bob and Kevin podcast with yours truly, along with John Shannon, as per usual. That's a grimaced look on your face there, Shannon.
No, I know.
What you would expect from a Leaf fan.
Well, if I was a Leaf fan, that would be a grimace.
Well, I confess to not being one either, but respectful of the fact that we live in a town where Leaf fans are predominant.
You think?
Well, I mean, were you shocked at the result last night? No, neither was I at all.
No. Not for game seven. I was shocked that it got to game five and six. But by the time game five ended, you could feel something really different about this series. And quite frankly, in my opinion, the Leafs just didn't match Montreal's intensity at any point in game six and seven.
Well, how's that even possible? How is it even possible for a team that played as well as this team did during the course of the regular season? And that was no mirage.
No.
How is it possible that you aren't mentally, emotionally ready for a playoff series, not just against a rival, because I think we make too much of that kind of stuff, but against a team that you beat comfortably, repeatedly,
seven times.
Course of the regular season, and that, quite frankly, can't match you in terms of skill set?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things that come to mind. Bob, perhaps the regular season was too easy for the Maple Leafs. Perhaps they started to believe that they were above and beyond the best team in this division, and no one could challenge them. The other thing I think is a little deeper, and I think it's funny. As the game ended, I was saying, "Well, this is all on the players. This is all on the players." But the longer I thought about it, it's not all on the players. It's not. This was a team that was built for the regular season. We always talk about, well, there's two different seasons. Playoff hockey is different than regular season hockey. The intensity is different. The intimidation factor is different. The toughness in the playoffs is different. Well, the Leafs have no toughness. And I'm not, when I talk about toughness, I'm not talking about cheap shots. I'm not talking about fighting. I'm talking about the physical nature and the art of intimidation in the National Hockey League. And the Leafs have none of that. They haven't had it for two or three seasons. And that's not on the players. That's on management who have built this club in a manner of speed. And they weren't that fast last night. Of style. And they have lots of style. But not necessarily built for playoff hockey. It's funny. So last night at my house, I'm watching the Maple Leaf game simultaneously with watching Lou Lamoriello's Islanders team win in overtime. And two of the most effective players for the Islanders last night through the whole game. I don't think they put any points on the scoreboard, but they were effective and they changed the tone of the game, were Matt Martin and Leo Komarov. Two former Leafs. That to me is indicative of something that needs to be addressed within the organization. It's funny, and I'm sorry to take so much time here. The one, Brendan Shanahan, 500 goal scorer, more than 1,000 penalty minutes. I mean, this guy was a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his name in the playoffs because he played tough. What the Toronto Maple Leafs and what Brendan Shanahan's Toronto Maple Leafs don't have as a player is Brendan Shanahan. And that kind of player wins cups. And that's why his name is on the Stanley Cup as a player. But right now there was not one ounce of pushback at any point last night. If Canadians pushed, the Leafs would skate away. And you may agree or disagree. Well, that's not the way they play. That is the way you play playoff hockey. And like, I didn't see someone so angry last night as a Maple Leaf that they were losing. I wanted to see somebody mad. I wanted to see somebody prove something, because I saw it in three or four members of the Montreal Canadiens through the last three games. I saw Brendan Gallagher mad. I saw Corey Perry mad. I saw Shea Weber mad. I saw people playing to the edge and not over the edge in Montreal. I never saw anybody in the Maple Leafs get to that edge, Bob. And I think that's a problem. And that's not on the players, because, you know, that they have been taught that this is how they want the game to be played. That's on management.
Well, I don't disagree with a word you said. I mean, Foligno was brought in, at least in part, because he can be.
He's a character guy. He's supposed to be that type of guy.
A tougher guy. Now, he was hurt, so badly. He was limited by what he could do. But the suggestion that they didn't bring in guys with that toughness is really not true. I mean, they did make an effort. I'm not defending them by any stretch of the imagination.
No. But those guys did not, they did not, I mean, you know, everybody reveled in the first couple of weeks of the season that Wayne Simmonds had changed the personality of the Maple Leafs. And
he did.
Wayne Simmonds wasn't a factor.
Well, and I saw there was a comment either made last night on television or that I read last night indicating that Simmonds actually was one of the better Leafs and did his job. And I agree with you. Simmonds was not brought to be a figure skater. He was not brought in to be a playmaker or a goal scorer. He was brought in to be a physical guy, a guy who mm-hmm. could potentially ram into somebody and hopefully turn a game around. It was none of that. I don't think it happened a single time. I have no recollection of a hit by him that was significant. Do you?
No, but the other thing was, it was quite visible, and in talking to a few people after the game last night, quite visible that you know, the big boys, you know, Matthews and Marner, to a lesser extent Nylander, who scored, he did what he was supposed to do through the series, score goals. They were emotionally spent, and how do you create an infrastructure of a hockey club where your two best players are emotionally spent like that?
Well, yeah, I want to raise another point here.
Wasn't for lack of trying, but I mean, goodness gracious, this is, you know, when we sit here for years and years and say, okay, they're going to pay this guy $10 million, we're going to pay this guy $10 million. Well, tell you what, you better get something for $10 million.
Well,
you better get something.
Well, I look at you. You're preaching to the choir here. Wow. The injury
it will be interesting, Bob. It will be interesting because there are a ton of parallels, Edmonton and Toronto, a ton of parallels. Both hugely disappointing playoffs for both organizations, some in similar ways. Now it's going to be fascinating to see how both organizations, how Kyle and Kenny react to what would be viewed as a cataclysmic spring.
I see that parallel, but I mean, you'd have to acknowledge this much. The Toronto Maple Leafs are and should be much further ahead in that process. I think Edmonton...
Why should they be further
ahead? Well, I think Edmonton still has pieces that they need to add to that puzzle.
I think the Leafs have pieces... I think the realization now, with three losses in a row to Montreal, that and with the amount of unrestricted free agents the Maple Leafs have, albeit they're not high end guys, and they're older guys. What do you do with Thornton? What do you do with Simmonds? What do you do with Spezza?
Well, you want the answer to that question?
You don't bring any of them back.
Well, I think you have to consider bringing Spezza back, but I don't think you consider bringing either of the other two guys back, with no disrespect mm-hmm. intended.
Yeah,
I don't think you don't blink.
And I think when you look at again, we're not talking about the Oilers too much, but when you think about the comparisons of Matthews and McDavid, Dreisaitl and Marner, Nurse and Riley, you know, there are a lot of comparisons on what's going to have to happen and how both teams are going to react to the spring of 2021.
Well, I would say Edmonton did not build a team that they thought was ready to win. They thought they built a team that was better with a new general manager, but not a finished product. The Toronto Maple Leafs thought they had a finished product.
Yeah.
And
that's fair. No, yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
it is finished because they're not playing anymore this year. And this extension of failure in postseason is a demon that hangs over them. And you can say whatever you want about the long history. Well, we weren't part of that. The last 3 years, this team is essentially, the nucleus of this team has essentially been together. And they have failed and failed repeatedly. But no failure was more dramatic, more emphatic, more definitive than this last one. They demonstrated after a weak performance in game one that they were the better team. They demonstrated that in games 2, 3, and 4. And then essentially went to sleep offensively in the first two periods of every game. Never came out with any energy, never came out with any determination, never exercised their will against Montreal in any way, shape, or form. And yeah, Carey Price played great, but he wasn't the fundamental difference. I think you would agree. A goaltender can stand on his head and win a series when you're badly outplayed. The Montreal Canadiens were not badly outplayed over the course of this series. You know, Leafs might have had an edge in territorial play, but it wasn't that great.
Oh, listen, Price. Here's what Carey did that Jack Campbell didn't. Price made every save he had to make and a couple of more. Jack Campbell whiffed on the first goal last night. He whiffed.
Yep.
You know, and so all of a sudden the balance changes. But here's a team, honestly, that I never thought we would ever say. Montreal was faster than the Maple Leafs last night. Faster. That's not supposed to be.
Well, so why? Is it because the coach overplayed the big line?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I really don't.
That's a factor.
I don't think it was anything physical. I think it was 100% mental. I think literally the Maple Leafs got to game 7 with the fear of losing, and the fear of losing overwhelmed the desire to win. You know, and we've seen this. We see this in day-to-day life. We see it all over the place. When the moment you become apprehensive, the moment you start to think rather than act instinctively, it is done. And well, that's exactly, in my opinion, that's what happened last night.
I'm not disagreeing with you at all. But the reality is there will be people who will then say, or who have already said, yeah, well, that's normal if you're up 3-1 and then you have to go to game 7. It's almost impossible to turn
that's
it around.
That's the difference between championship teams and teams that get eliminated.
Well, you need only teams, go back.
They put the pedal to the metal.
You only have to go back less than a week and see what Vegas did in game 7 against Minnesota. Because the exact same scenario took place. Mm-hmm. Vegas got beat in games 5 and 6 and had to play a game 7 that they didn't expect to play or want to play, and dominated that game and won 6-2, I think. Now, the stress of that 7-game series wiped them out for game 1 against Colorado, but that's a bridge that the Toronto Maple Leafs would like to be on.
So what do you do, Bob? If you're Larry Tannenbaum and you're the board, are you Brendan Shanahan's under contract, Kyle Dubas is under contract, Sheldon Keefe's under contract? What do you do to those three guys?
Well, what I do and what I think will be done are two entirely different things.
Okay, no. I want to know what you would do.
Well, I think they all have to be accountable. And as of this date, the experiment that Kyle Dubas has put in place, and let me say this, I have nothing against Kyle Dubas. I quite like the guy. And I respected the decisions that he has made. because they weren't the easiest ones. They were contrary to popular theory. So I respect that, but it hasn't worked. I have said all along that you cannot have four guys in the $7+ million salary range and win. Maybe you can have three. You seven, certainly can have
two of them are over 10. Two of them are over 10.
Well, that's my point. And you can make the argument that Nylander was the best of the four. I mean, Tavares was hurt, so you don't you can't put him on the list. But Nylander produced. I don't know if he played better, but he produced better than either Matthews or Marner.
When it tell you what, if Matthews and Marner have five goals each like Nylander, the Leafs win in four.
Agreed. Having said that, I do not put Nylander's skill sets at the same place that I put Marner and Matthews under normal circumstances. And I would not have signed Nylander. And if I'm going to, you can't trade Tavares. He has a no trade. Are you interested? And I don't know what the other two contracts are.
They have limited no moves as well.
Okay. Nylander doesn't, I don't think.
No.
I don't think he has any limitations. I think you gotta rebuild this thing. And maybe you rebuild it out of necessity around Tavares, Matthews, and Marner. But I don't think you keep Nylander. And it's not a criticism of him. He was their best player during the playoffs in terms of goal scoring. But there are things about his game that I don't like. And he demonstrated them last night. He thinks himself first and pass second. And there were opportunities last night for him to make passes to open players in front of the net at least twice. And he went for a skate to try and create something himself. Now, that's not the end of the world, but it just demonstrates something. And frankly, you're not going to trade the leading goal scorer in the NHL. I don't think that's ever been done in history. Well, maybe Gretzky, huh? I don't remember if he was the leading goal scorer that year. But
he probably wasn't, but close.
Well, but he was close. And Marner, I said to you and to Kiprios yesterday, I asked the question, is Marner hurt? And, or is Marner just pooped? Because he wasn't even remotely the player that we saw over the course of the year.
I think Marner was emotionally spent.
He was physically spent too, because the moves that he made during the regular season to get him out of trouble and be able to make plays mostly to Matthews were absent last night. He coughed up the puck on the first goal at the blue line. You know, those are the kinds of things you didn't see. He didn't make critical mistakes.
Yeah. But tell you what, the organization take a step back. They should, you know, wait a week because you don't want to do anything and be reactive emotionally. And we know that that's what's going to happen. But I seriously think that it makes some sense to move one of the big four. I agree with
that's
you.
What I'm saying. And the guy that I would move is Nylander.
But I don't think it's Nylander.
Well, then who is it? It's not Tavares, so it's Matthews or Marner.
It's a good answer.
You're going to move Marner. Right?
I'll tell you at the end of the show.
No, tell me now.
I'll tell you at the end of the show.
A tease. Now, mind you, it's a tease. It's only John Shannon's opinion.
That's right.
About $6 will get you a copy.
The last 20 minutes, you said you're not wrong about 68 times, but that's okay.
Well, you're not wrong so far. I'm predicting we all know the answer to the question.
Okay.
We'll get the opinion of someone else.
Sure.
Mark Curtin was a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs and Vancouver
and Detroit. Yeah.
And if you don't know Mark's story, we'll tell you that as well. He is next when we continue on this program after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon. We return to the program. And we're joined by a former member of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Mark Curtin is with us from Oakville. Well, you had a chance to watch last night's, for lack of a better term, debacle. You are old enough to have seen, like John and I have, more than a few of these. Were you, first of all, were you surprised at the outcome, Mr. Curtin?
You know what? Not really, Bob. When you go into a game seven against Carey Price, you know what? There's got to be doubt in your mind about it. You know, there's no question. And he was getting stronger and stronger as that game went on. As the series went on, he was getting stronger, stronger. So I think going into game seven, you know, I sort of anticipated a similar start to like game six was, where they were up tight, holding their sticks a little bit tight, and you can't play that way, you know? And then as soon as you fall behind, it's even tougher because you get tired faster, more doubt slips into your mind, and it just gets tougher and tougher. So was the outcome a surprise to me? No, not really. I felt that they had to get that first goal or the first couple goals so they would relax and play their game, and it didn't happen. So it was a battle all the way, and it was tough to watch. And now we've got a city that's crippled.
Yeah.
Well,
hey, so Mark, I mentioned to Bob in the previous segment that I don't believe the Maple Leafs approach to playoff hockey is the way it should be. I think there needs to be a little more toughness in the lineup, a little more aggressiveness in the lineup. Where do you sit on that?
You know what? To be honest, did you watch the Boston game? Like, I flipped over to the Boston game, and granted, the atmosphere was different. The you know, place was full with fans and all that stuff. But you know what? That team knows how to win. They know how to win. Their core knows how to win. And I think until we win a series or two with our core, we're going to have the same thing over and over again every year. Because Boston, I mean, that line, I mean, are they winners or what, those guys? I mean, when they goal, they get it. Now they lost in overtime last night, but they came back two down. So I don't know if it's I think there's two things. One is the core needs to learn how to win, but I think that if we look and see what Montreal did, they had a couple young guys in the lineup where we had older guys, right? And their young guys that came in played very well. And our older guys were okay. So I'm not sure toughness is it, John. Not in today's game. I just think that, you know, it's something that we just have to learn to do, our core.
Well, you mentioned Carey Price and his performance. His performance aside, Kiprios was with us yesterday, and I asked him this question. If, as a player, when you know that the goaltender on the other team is acknowledged as one of the best in the game and has a history of stealing games, winning literally games all by himself, like, how much tighter do you grip your stick? How much more time do you take trying to find to create the perfect shot rather than just firing it on the net? And I'm intrigued by your perspective as a former player of that.
Do you know what? You're bang on. Like, there may be players that say, oh, no, it doesn't affect me. I'm, you know, but it does. There's no question, especially when he's made a couple early saves in the game. Then you really start to think about it. But let's think about this for a second. You've got Carey Price in net. He's getting stronger and stronger as the series goes on. And then you've got a team that collapses. So in other words, when the puck's on the point or on the outside perimeter, you know, five Montreal guys collapse into the slot. Listen, when I coached minor hockey or rep hockey years ago, and I played against a team that was better than us, I used to have my five guys collapse in the slot all the time. Do you know how many legs there is to go through to shoot? Sure. That's why there's so many block shots. And so then if you do get a shot through, you got Carey Price there. So it's a whole bunch of things. And I knew when we were up 3-1, I knew that, boy, we better win that next one. And worst case, six. Because going to seven, I would have bet the house, unfortunately, against us. It's just the way it is.
Well, you're five guys down low. Sounds very much like your old junior coach, huh?
Roger?
Roger Nielsen? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know what? Right. Yeah, absolutely. We were laughing about it the other day, actually. You know, Roger, anybody that comes out of Peterborough can play a 200-foot game, right? Running four lines and Dick Todd and Keenan and all those guys. But, boy, Roger sure put a defensive checker penalty killer tag on me, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. And then I'd go down to the American League and you get 70-some points. And I call Roger up and I say, how come when I come back up, I'm a checker again? You know, but that's the way the game works, right?
You and Jimmy.
Jimmy Jones, yeah. Well, that's a whole nother story, John, because if back in 1978, when Roger drafted me, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on a championship team here, because they lost to Montreal four straight, but nobody in the world was going to beat Montreal then, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to replace Jonesy because I got a little more offense, and this is going to be great. And then Harold jumped in and absolutely destroyed our team, you know, just destroyed it. And then, because that team was only about two players away from challenging, you know?
Sure. What was it like? Being a local guy, Southern Ontario guy, what was it like to play for the Maple Leafs, and what was the pressure like? And I know we're in 2021 now, and it's 1978 or 79. What was the pressure like to play for your hometown team?
You know what? I was in such a different space mentally that it didn't bother me at all, not at all. And, you know, I remember Roger, when I got drafted, of course, back then I was sitting on my front lawn when I got drafted. Quenneville was, they didn't have a first round pick. So Q was second round and I was third. And Roger calls me right away and he says, I just want to warn you. He says, you know, the press here in Toronto is really tough and they're going to be calling you because I drafted you and all this stuff. So he was prepping me and everything. And so, you know what? I just didn't want to let him down, guys. So I worked out so hard that summer and went in phenomenal shape and had a pretty good camp and went down to the minors where there was an older team down there and a whole new set of stories from that team. With Eddie Johnson coaching us and sure. Him and Pat Quinn fighting at center ice and all those stories. And you know what? When I made the team in my second year, for some reason, I didn't feel the pressure. I don't know why. It had nothing to do with hometown or anything like that. I was just so ultra focused on doing what I could do to stay there. So it's kind of a interesting answer, but I didn't feel pressure.
I must ask you, everybody who's a Leaf fan, even a hockey observer, is armed today with an opinion on what is next for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And it's interesting, Mark, because the last couple of years, I don't think we felt that way. The consensus sort of was, you've got this nucleus of young players that is very talented. They're building. They still need a couple more pieces, etc. But this was the year that Kyle Dubas put the pieces in place, the pieces that he wanted, virtually without limitation. I guess some limitation because of the salary cap, but he put together a team that he thought he could win with. And now they have failed to do that. And we're going to spend the next several months, I assume, assessing what you do next. If it was you, what would you do?
Boy, oh boy, it's a tough one. One thing you said that resonates with me, and I agree with you, is that we really didn't think we were going to be in this position, were we? Mm-hmm. Like talking about this, because I actually thought they'd come out of the North no problem, and I was going to bet the house on it. But so now this has just whacked us. Like, I don't know about you, but I mean, you know, I bleed blue and white. I want them to win bad. And it bothered me. I hardly even slept last night. I was so upset by it, you know, as all of Leaf Nation was. So I think one thing they can't do is just react, right? I mean, right, it's the first thing that pops in your head. You want to react. You want to get rid of this guy. You want to get rid of that guy. But, and I don't want to give you the token answer that they're probably giving you, but at the end of the day, you really do need to sit back and say, what went wrong here? What went wrong? And, you know, I have to give Jack Campbell credit because going into it, I wasn't sure that he could hold the fort in the pressure. But you know what? He kept him in game six. And game seven, he played pretty good yesterday. The first one he should have had, I think. But you know what? He kept them in. So, Bob, I don't know the answer. I don't know whether it's, you know, I think the management has to be looked at too, not just the players. You have to look from the top to the bottom because I don't know how many years Shanny's had there. Is it five? I don't know.
Six
yeah. years. You know, I don't know what goes on in the dressing room. Actually, I should call Pappy, I guess. Then I'll get the scoop. Then I could have answered it better.
You don't want to get Brian and Jay. You know,
I'm just kidding. Pappy,
I know, but
Pappy doesn't say anything. But you know what? I think every bit of that organization needs to be looked at. And you're right. We're going to talk about this till we're blue in the face. But changes, well, they brought in older guys. But you know what? There's some, when you bring in older guys that have won, that's good for the room, good for the culture. So you have to have that. But I didn't think that those Montreal guys, those two young guys, what's his name? The guy, Caulfield?
Yeah, I mean, Caulfield and Cockymany, yeah.
Think about the damage those two guys did, right? So maybe that's the prototype. You know, you bring in Robertson, and who else do we have that's young and good? You know, inject that. So I don't know, guys.
Listen, Marner and Matthews aren't much older than Caulfield.
No, true, but Caulfield came in at the end, right?
Yeah, he did. He came out of Wisconsin, yeah.
Well, see, that's what I mean, because when you're injecting the team with a couple guys late in the season, that's always helpful too, by the way. Bringing in a couple guys. I remember near the trading deadline or whatever, you bring in a couple guys, everybody looks at each other and goes, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, my junior year in Peterborough, Gary Green was coaching, went to the Memorial Cup, and we were sitting at Maple Leaf Gardens getting ready to play the Marlies. And Keith Acton and I and Crowder are sitting beside each other because we knew Gary Green had recruited some guy from Michigan State. So we're sitting there, and we weren't that tough of a team, right? And we knew we needed some toughness. So in comes Gary with Jeff Brubaker on his wing. This guy came in like a mountain, and he was like that Buford Pusser or whatever that guy's name was, walking tall. He came in and he went around and he started shaking all our hands. And I said to Acton, I said, Woody, our problems are all over. I said, you know what? I said, we have no more problems. I said, the only fight's going to be between me and you, who gets him on his wing. And I got him. So you see, you know what? We got him, and then we breezed through Hamilton and the Secords and Coolisses and Ottawa, Bobby Smith. We just went right through.
Sure.
So one little tinker can do it if it's the right tinker. And that's
hold
what
on. So,
with
so
the
that's,
Leafs
that,
as well.
That sounded like the Peterborough Petes added a little toughness, Mark. Memory, sure. You know, I mean, so I'm starting. Yeah, I think you're coming around to my side of this argument now. So,
well, yeah, you know what? I kind of did, didn't I? But you know what? You need the right tinker. That's what I'm saying.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely.
Well, but you need the Leafs brought in guys who they purported would be tough and who weren't.
Wow.
Who didn't we don't know if they're hurt, themselves. Bob. We don't know if, like, it looked like Nick. It looked like.
Well, Nick was hurt.
Yeah,
Nick was on one leg. Nick was on one leg, Mark. You can tell. You can just see it.
I'm going to throw something out there that crossed my mind about halfway through that series, too. You know, it appeared to me a few times where our core was getting tired. I don't know if you guys noticed that as well, but you know, the core, when I say the core, Matthews, Marner, mainly, I thought Nylander played very well last night. But the two guys look tired at times. So you almost wonder whether their minutes were too much too.
Well, they were getting 26, 27 minutes. Yeah. And Riley played, I don't know, I didn't even see the total, but at 30 to 32, 35.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't, and that was that happened in games 5, 6, and 7. To do it one night is one thing. To have to do it every other night for 3 games and 5 nights, that's pretty tough for anybody.
Well, Bob, and yes, and the fact that the series is slowly slipping, right?
Yeah.
So let's put that in your brain for a second. And I'm going to tell you, you get tired way faster when you're coming from behind.
Of course.
Series is slipping, or you just can't get a hockey god break. And they couldn't get a break. And then, enough, they get a shot that bounces off, knee and into the net.
Corey Perry.
Yeah.
By the way, Riley last night, 26-17 was his ice time, Bob.
Wow.
That's all?
Yep. Yeah. The overtime games, he might have been over 30, but.
Wow.
That's a lot less than I thought. Bottom line, guys, like he was out there.
The core needs to win. The core needs to learn to win.
We're gonna take a break, and we're gonna tell you a little bit about Mark's personal story, and we'll do that after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon with you. Mark Curtin is with us, former Leaf, former NHL player.
Tell you what, he's the best analyst we've had on this week. So,
well, principally because he started to side with you and your opinion.
That's excellent point, Robert. Excellent point.
Well, I know that's the criteria for you, but I'm not arguing the point. His analysis has been pretty accurate. A few years ago, you got a shocking diagnosis that you had ALS, better known to some as Lou Gehrig's disease, a disease for which there is no cure. And a disease that is, I gather from what I've read, starting to affect you in a variety of physical ways. I can't even imagine, none of us can imagine what this is like for you, but I must ask you how you dealt with it in the early days. I sort of can understand that you must come to terms with it over time. But the shock of that initial diagnosis must have been horrific for you.
You know what? It was. And but it was gradual, because in 2015 is when I had my first symptom. And I was sitting on a beach in Bahamas reading Bob McKenzie's book. And I was actually reading Coley Campbell's chapter of when he almost died. I don't know if you guys were familiar with that.
In the tractor.
Story. Pardon?
In the tractor.
In the tractor, yeah. And so I called him, and he said, and we talked about it, and then I told him my right arm won't stop twitching. And I said, I don't know what the problem is. I said, I didn't work out or anything like that. And he says, well, you better get it checked. And so I started to, my right hand started getting weaker. And I remember golfing with Boudreaux, Gabby. And I couldn't squeeze my golf cup that well, and it would slip out of my hands, and Gabby, of course, wouldn't give me any strokes, the bugger, after 9 holes. So, you know what? Fast forward, I had a little fall here, a fall there, the dumbbell curl would fall out of my hands. So I did a whole bunch of testing for 3 years, and I actually thought I had Lyme disease because it came back positive, and it mirrors Lou Gehrig. And I had a positive test out of California, but then I found out that 80% of the tests are positive out of there. So that wasn't the case. So I went to the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, infusions, blood work, naturopaths, rheumatologists, everything. And finally, in 2018, 3 years later, almost to the day, Sunnybrook diagnosed it as ALS. And that's a tough one. Lisa and I were in there, and you know, your whole world crumbles in like 10 seconds. And so you get out of there, and you look at each other and say, where do we go from here? And of course, then he tells you the lifeline is, 2 to 5 years, which I told him that that's fine if that's the averages, but I plan on, I'm not following that guideline. I gotta be around a lot longer than that. So the first thing we thought of is how do we tell the kids? And then we got through that. And then it started to spread around me like a clock. It went from right arm to left leg to right leg. And as it was moving around me, but let me back up. When I got out of Sunnybrook, I just looked at myself in the mirror and said, okay, you have two choices. It's a humbling, it's a horrific diagnosis, but you can either go in the corner and get depressed and cry about it, or you can just, stand up and face it. It's a card you've been dealt. And I promised myself my personality would never, ever change. And if anybody tried to feel sorry for me or pity or anything like that, I'm going to stop them in their tracks, because I want to be chirping and I want to chirp people. I want them to chirp me. I don't want to change whatsoever. And that's how I decided to move forward with it. So it's been a tough, route at times, but to answer your question, Bob, yeah, I just decided I would face it head on.
Now I understand, Mark, you're on. Go ahead, John.
Mark, are there days that you think you're a victim?
Yeah, I suppose when I have because there is no cure for this, and they really don't know what causes it. Do I go, why me? Yeah, sometimes I do, but not a lot, because I don't allow myself to get depressed. And, even though the impact is on my life, the impact is really on my family too. Like people that say, oh, he has ALS, so what have you, sort of the family that has it too. And because as I weaken, they're an extension of me, right? So like, if I can't do something, they're right there on the front line to help. And so I'm so proud of them to be near me around the clock when I need it. But I have, yes, I'll have some down times, but I don't let anybody see it, because at the end of the day, if I'm down, everybody else is down. If I'm up, everybody else is up. And it's just not in my DNA anyways. I mean, you know what I'm like, John. I'm always up trying to be upbeat.
I am made to understand that you are, I believe, currently on some medication. I believe it's Asian medication, Japanese, I think, that is supposed to mitigate the onset of the symptoms. How have you found that? And do you feel like that is, can you tell if it's working?
Well, you know what? It's a really good question, because we have a little bit of debate here at the house on it. But first of all, there is two treatments that are out there. One is called Edaravone from Japan. Yes, I've been on it. As a matter of fact, I just started my 305th treatment. You can believe it. Over 29 months or whatever it is. And I go on this treatment 10 days a month. And it's just an IV into the arm for 10 days, an hour. And my daughter, who's 16, actually does it.
Wow.
Now, the other one is just a couple pills a day. But what I was going to say is, when I started going on Edaravone 2 years and a bit, my legs were strong as could be. You know, I only had it in my right arm. But since then, it's really hit my legs hard, and basically they're fried. So my wife thinks that, what would it have been like if you didn't go on the treatment? Mm. Maybe your legs would still be okay. But my response is, well, if I didn't go on the treatment, maybe it would be in my front by now, where I wouldn't be able to breathe or swallow or eat or talk. So you know what? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'm staying on it, because if it stays in my limbs and even slows more and stays out of my front, then I'm still in a win position, you see? So, but you know, we need more than that, not just the two treatments. I mean, there's 160 drug companies around the world that are in the ALS space right now, and there's 80 trials that are going into phase two and phase three. So there's a lot of positives around the world. So when they get that magic potion, then the trick is to get it into our bodies fast. And Bob, I will tell you that when edaravone finally got approved, actually, sorry, when it came across into the States and the FDA approved it, and then Health Canada approved it, and then provincial approved it, do you know how long that took? 2 years.
Yeah.
So think about it. They get a magic potion in the States. You think I got 2 years to wait for that?
No.
So that's one of the three major asks that the ALS community's fighting for. Government faster pathways so we can get drugs into us as soon as they get a good treatment. And it's a struggle.
Well, one of the dilemmas that I'm sure you face, let me ask you this straightforwardly. If there was an experimental drug that you were allowed to take, but had no guarantees, no idea what, if any, side effects would take place, would you take it?
You know what? The way I am right now, today, I would probably want to research it more and more and more and more before I made that decision. But if I get to the point where I'm losing my voice and I'm having difficulty breathing or something like that, I'm all over it. I'm all over it. Oh. But right now, my life is... Now, I will tell you that a lot of these treatments, one in Sunnybrook, as a matter of fact, that looks like it's going to be very positive. Would I try that? You know what? I can put up with the side effects. I would just want to know how dangerous it could be if I took it, I guess.
Of course.
At the stage I'm at right now. But if I worsened, then I, like I said, I'd be all over it for sure. 100%. But good question.
So this is June is ALS month in our country. There's the June 20th is the walk to end ALS. Tomorrow in Major League Baseball, June 2nd is Lou Gehrig Day, which is, I think, a dramatic move from Major League Baseball to acknowledge what has gone on with the disease. Where do you think we are with awareness of ALS, Mark?
Well, I'm going to tell you, June 2nd, in my mind, is the biggest day ever for ALS. Because don't forget, it's been 80 years, I think, since Lou Gehrig passed away of this. And finally, MLB, who in some respects, I think that they should be accountable because he's one of theirs. And finally, they've come up to the plate with the greatest awareness day ever. And I think to have our story heard across Canada or across the land and have it resonate with people to rally to our cause is like never before. And so, you know, if it's successful and the awareness gets out there and the general public understands more about this illness and gets behind our back, well, maybe that's when the government will stand up and take notice and they'll facilitate instead of frustrate us, right? So it's a huge, huge day. The donation stuff is the end of the month, but the awareness of tomorrow is a day we're all looking forward to. And I just think it'll get stronger and stronger each year. But what I'd like to see happen, guys, is that, like, it's a whole nother conversation, but I have a list of 75 former athletes that have had ALS or have it. And I did that list in 2 hours. Okay. So it's a very, it's a crazy list. And I'm going to tell you, there's about 40 of them that are NFL football players.
Right.
And so if the NFL doesn't stand up and look at what MLB's doing in June 2nd, there's something wrong. So I think the NFL has got to look at this and say, hey, we got a lot of guys too. And have a Sunday of Lou Gehrig Day. That's what I'd like to see come out of this.
You talked about how the government frustrates you, and we you told us about the 2 years for the drug that you're taking. What do you want government to do?
Well, the problem, it's a forgotten illness, John. You know, 80 years ago. Okay, let's look at it this way. There's a lot of fearless leaders. Okay, there's the two guys that started the ice bucket challenge, right? Mm-hmm. Made millions. They're both gone. There is Brian Wallach, who is a king in the States, IMALS, and he's a former Obama guy, and he is just such a battler, and he's a leader, and he's starting to hurt now. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of ALS Action Canada, which is a patient-led group, which is strong. And then there's ALS Canada, which is another group. Okay, well, my ALS Action Canada, there's some guys in that group that are starting to hurt. So where I'm going with this is this. You've got these fearless leaders moving along, and guess what happens? They pass hope. They build huge momentum, and then they're gone. And then the next guy comes, huge momentum, then they're gone. And so that's one of the big problems as to why we haven't broke through. Now, as far as the government goes, the frustrating part is back in 2017, there was a motion put through called Motion 105 because they lost one of their own in the House. And this guy was a battler. And what ended up happening is that they put the motion through and they said that they would work annually to promote ALS awareness, raise funds and all that stuff. Not one thing was done in the last 4 years, okay? That's just one of the many things that were promised that just didn't come through, but that's one that sticks in my head for sure. So we need to make a dent somewhere. We had 26,000 Canadians sign a petition, and the petition was to be taken to the government and said, hey, we need faster pathways. We need these drugs in our body 3 to 6 months. And to date, Health Canada turned it down and nothing's been done about it. So we just keep running into walls, but we got to keep fighting.
Mark, you obviously are a fighter. I know I speak for John. We are... it's a devastating thing that you face. You face it with courage and with dignity. And you are to be admired for that in many, many ways. It was so enjoyable to have a chance to chat with you. And hopefully we'll have a chance to do it again, maybe many times. And let's hope that there is a miracle out there. And I know that everybody watching or listening to this shares that sentiment. We wish you the best health possible. And let's have another conversation real soon, okay?
You know what, Bob? Thanks for inviting me, guys, because every little bit helps on the awareness front. And, you know, it's all I can say is that be aware that time is a pretty valuable commodity.
Yes, sir.
And it's often taken for granted. So, when you hear a story like this, or you see a story, just take a look in the mirror yourself and say, hey, you know what? It's time to enjoy day by day.
Well you tell you what, you're a good man, and your family, as you said, the ALS is now something for your whole family. So, give them a hug for us, and
I will.
Let's make June a special month.
Yeah, I will do that, John, for sure. And just a shout out to the sports community as well, because the rallying, I mean, when you ask people for video, short promo videos, and, you know, guys like Wendell Clark, like 20 minutes sent out. It's incredible.
All the best, Mark, and thank you for your time today. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Mark Curtin, we'll come back and wrap this up after these messages. And we are back, Bob McCowan and John Shannon. And again, our sincere thanks to Mark Curtin. The bravery
puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Sure does. Everything puts everything into perspective. His bravery is extraordinary. Just absolutely extraordinary. We are sincere in hoping that we'll have many more opportunities to chat with him. His analysis of hockey at the beginning was pretty good too.
Yeah. Here's the interesting thing about Mark is that Mark has always been one of the predominant real estate agents in Oakville. Mm-hmm. 2020 was his best year.
That's fantastic.
You know, and that puts it, and you can see, A, how he could, you see in the way he works, how he can sell houses, and you can see his fight. So he's a remarkable guy, and his point about how those people who fight for ALS at some point just disappear and the fight away is something that the rest of us should probably pick up on a great deal more. So it's that's. I'm glad we did that one, Bob. I'm glad we did that one.
As am I. Well, you teased the audience at the beginning of this program by saying that they had to wait. More importantly, yeah. I had to wait.
Yeah.
For your divine opinion of what the Toronto Maple Leafs should do. Before we extend this program into several hours, give us the great analysis of the wonderful Wizard of Shannon.
Well, I tell you what, I do think that, I don't think this core can win.
I agree. The question is, what do you do?
And I think you have to look at it from two perspectives, is who can get you the most coming back? And how would you replace them? And I do think that Mitch Marner is the guy that would get you the most on the market. Remember, this is a team that even in the short term doesn't have I think they only have three draft picks, period, at the summer draft.
I think you're right.
I think Marner is the guy that you would try to, after you take a sober second thought and look at things and where this team goes and what you value. And Mitch Marner's the guy that if you had to contemplate moving somebody, it would be number 16. It wouldn't be the other guys. It would be number 16. And it would open up in theory some cap space. And there would be, I think if Kyle put the shingle out to say, very quietly, Marner's on the market, I think that there would be a long line of people saying, we'll take him, and they'll get a king's ransom for him.
Well, he would not be my first choice. I've made that clear, but I do understand your position on it. And
I think one of the reasons that Nylander isn't is because Nylander's contract now looks pretty stable. And he's not expensive compared to the other three.
Well, he's 7 and the others are 10-5, give or take. You know, I mean, yeah. we're rounding it off.
Yeah.
Look, if you're going to blow it up, and the preliminary consensus seems to be this team isn't going to win with four players at $40 million, maybe the correct answer is both of them.
No, not Matthews.
Well,
not
Matthews. You can say no all you want.
I just did. Here's the other thing, and this is where I think management probably was sit to say, well, listen, we did all this except for 11 minutes without John Tavares. You know, I mean, one of the guys who was supposed to be a cornerstone, and it was a freak.
You yourself said earlier they can't win with this group, and now you're backtracking and saying
the Tavares absence. I'm still moving Marner. I am.
Well, I understand what you're
saying.
Because
they should be able to win without Tavares too.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I'm moving Nylander, but I'm making the argument that perhaps if you really concede that this team is broken, you're going to move two wingers. You're going to keep your two centers, because one of the things that hockey people like you have said for ever is you have to have strength down the middle.
Down the middle, sure. Well, then you're not getting rid of Matthews.
Keep your two centers and you hope your goaltender was not a mirage this year, because you're probably going to lose Anderson.
Yeah.
And you may not care, but.
Ooh, that's a good one too.
We'll have plenty of time to discuss this in more detail, if that's even possible. Let's get out of here before everybody gets bored, myself included. Thank you, Mr. Shannon, as always.
And thank you to Mark Curtin.
100%. We hope you enjoyed it. Come back and hear us, see us again tomorrow. Same time or whatever time you want to. For John Shannon, Bob McCallum, goodbye, everybody.